Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In March 2009, pretty vivacious Rhonda Casto plunged to her death from a 300-foot cliff in the Oregon woods. The only witness, Stephen Nichols, the father of her nine-month-old baby, Annie, told police investigators she slipped and fell. Yet Nichols' story didn't quite mesh with the facts, and some of his other actions raised suspicions as well, including just days after her death trying to collect on a $1 million life insurance policy he'd taken out on his unemployed 23-year-old girlfriend 4 months earlier. What had begun with a 911 call to report an accident quickly turned into a homicide investigation. However, in part due to lackluster police work, the case grew cold. Then in 2011, Darty Robinson, a tenacious investigator with a Portland law firm, began digging into the circumstances surrounding Rhonda's death. The law firm represented Rhonda's mother, who believed that Nichols, 34 at the time, had murdered her daughter. She wanted to prevent him from gaining custody of Annie and the life insurance money. What Robinson discovered, including an attempt by Nichols to throw his first wife off a high-rise balcony in China, as well as sexual abuse allegations with Rhonda's underage sister, convinced her that Rhonda's death was no accident. So began her six-year battle to save Annie from her father and find justice for Rhonda. In the meantime, a parallel investigation into the case by co-author Steve Jackson, an award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author, and private investigator Tom McCallum posed the same questions. What really happened to Rhonda Casto on that cold, rainy afternoon on the Eagle Creek Trail? And what would become of her child? The book that we're featuring this evening is Saving Annie, Book 1, The Fall, a true crime series, with my special guest, journalist and author and publisher, Steve Jackson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Jackson.
Hi there, Dan. As always, a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure for myself, and I know it's a real treat for the audience. You only deal with extraordinary cases, and this is no exception. Let's start right away with, I guess we won't give too much away, but we want to talk about that this Saving Annie is being published as a series of four books broken into distinct parts of the investigation. So just explain what Saving Annie is as part of that four-book series.
Well, okay. We're trying something new here, which is the serialization of this book. The entire book's called Saving Annie, and then each one of the four parts, which we're also calling a book, as you sometimes do, it is a distinct part of this case. It was, even before I made this decision to try to do this, it was, it just lays itself out that way naturally as four parts. I kind of came up with this idea of, I've been kind of watching the serialization of podcasts, such as Serial, which became very well-known, and noticed how each part of the series sort of created buzz and people talking about the first part and then looking forward to the second part. And I remember back when I was a kid and I used to subscribe to Boys Life, and they'd have a story in there, and I couldn't wait till the next month, and I'd talk to my friends about it, and we'd wonder, what happens in the next part. So I thought I would try this little experiment in publishing and see, you know, how it worked this way. There are several other reasons. One is it is a there's a lot of material to this book. If you take all four parts of the book, it's a very large book, especially in the way I wanted to write about it and the detail I wanted to include. So, you know, that was sort of the impetus behind it.
Now, let's talk about the genesis of this entire project. In December 2011, you got a call from an old friend, Tom McCallum. But you were surprised, but you hadn't heard from him for about 20 years. Now, tell us who he was, when you met, and the circumstances, and just of your friendship, and before you talk about the content of that call. Originally, he had called for advice, you said, after all these years, but tell us a little bit about this relationship, and tell us then about that call and what he had to say.
Well, I'd originally met Tom in 1990. The head of the Oregon Corrections Department had been murdered in January of 1989, and I was an investigative reporter for a newspaper in Salem, Oregon at the time, and had been covering this story for quite a bit. It was a very different story in that it had quickly become apparent to me that the police were sort of had settled on, oh, it must have been a stranger came upon the corrections department director Michael Franke in the parking lot at night, robbed him. There's a robbery gone bad. But there were a lot of things were going on at that time that indicated it might be something more of a conspiracy. And so I have been working on this story for about a year when the police had arrested a young man, a meth addict, a small-time criminal named Frank Gable, and had settled on him as the suspect, and not just the suspect but you know this idea that he had you know come upon Frankie, tried to rob him, got in a fight, killed him, and a lot of that just didn't add up. And it's a great story itself. It's one I plan on writing someday. And even though it's been, like you said, it's been 20 some odd years. Sure. But anyway, as I was writing about this story and Frank Gable had been arrested, I get a call from a guy identifies himself as Tom McCallum and says he's an investigator for Gable's defense attorney and wants to know if I can talk to if he can talk to me. And, you know, I'm an investigative reporter and I was doing my own work and spent a year doing this. And this guy calls up and wants to know everything I know. So I basically told him in several choice words where he could go with that and hung up the phone. He called back and tried to get a little bit farther. And I repeated the process of hanging up the phone. And he called the next day, and he kept at it and said, hey, I'll buy you lunch. You know, we don't even have to talk about this. And from there, he gained my trust. I gained his trust. We both were working from different ways, different avenues on this same story. And over time became friends and fishing buddies and everything else, even long after that story was gone. And then I moved from Oregon and back to Colorado. And we didn't completely lose in a while on the phone or emailed or something like that. But when he called in December 2011, I hadn't heard from him for quite some time. And as you note, it was a different kind of phone call.
Now, he talks about he's asking you about advice about a book. So he's endeavoring to do that. And, of course, is a good person to call for advice would be you. But he also has a conversation with you about a client, this Gary Castor, who's an extremely rich guy, like you say, a multi-billionaire. And he had employed Tom and asked Tom to help him look into a guy that was being a private investigator, look into this guy who was dating his daughter, Mindy. Now, you must have found this interesting. What did he say about this person, and who was this person that he had found, and what had he found out about this person who was dating his daughter?
Right. Basically, Gary Caster, which is an alias for someone else, was very concerned. You know, he's a very wealthy man, as you pointed out, so you know, he's got to be careful about who gets close to his family. And his daughter had brought this guy over. He had a young daughter, 3 or 4 years old at the time, and brought her to a family Christmas thing, or brought him to the family Christmas thing with his daughter. And nobody got a good feeling from him. They just felt he was, creepy, and he's sort of monotone and emotionless, and a number of people there, including the ranch foreman where this wealthy person and his family have a ranch there in Central Oregon. And so he just called Tom to sort of run a background check on this guy and see if there was anything notable, or if maybe he was just an odd duck and they were all misjudging him or something along those lines. But Tom started to look into this guy, ran some crime checks on him, and found some restraining orders for domestic violence. There were some allegations of sexual improprieties, and started finding more and more about this guy that, obviously red flags with the domestic violence and the restraining orders. And then right toward the end of it, they discovered because this guy was involved in a custody case over the child, found out that he was also had been suspected of having girlfriend, the child's mother, off a cliff. And as Tom looked into this, it seemed like, whatever happened to this case, did they resolve it? Did they close it? Did they determine it was an accident? Was it still going? And Tom found out that it was still an open investigation, but they didn't seem to be doing much.
Now, as a result, when you heard this story and you got this information, he's planning to write a book. What's the agreement between the two? What do you guys decide to do as a result of what you've just heard and everything, all the information that he has, and both of you in the position that you are at that time? What do you decide to do?
Well, actually, Tom was working on a different book, a different true crime. I was the one, sort of together, I guess. I started talking about it. It's an interesting case. Maybe I'd be interested in it as a book. Tom was also thinking that he could use some help on the investigative end, as far as I'm pretty good at paper chases and finding documents and as well as interviews, and that maybe coming at it from not together necessarily. I wasn't working as a PI, and he wasn't necessarily working as a journalist, even though at a different point he's been wanting to write true crime books. And I said, well, why don't you learn by working with me on this book as a writer and journalist as well. So basically we just sort of combined forces, if you will, and started looking into the case. There was a lot to run down as far as documents and finding people who could have been witnesses, some people who would have popped up on the witness list if I was a detective, and who hadn't even been talked to by the police at this point, though they would at a point.
Right.
And so that's sort of how we got started on it and started finding more and more. And, you know, there's the little girl was sort of central in this, Annie.
Right.
And as we started looking into this, we're wondering, did the mother, Rhonda Castro, you know, had the police done everything they could to make sure that, you know, the case was closed one way or the other, either through justice or if they ruled it in some other way, then fine, but also for the little girl's sake.
Yes, you're right that she was 9 months old when her mother died, and Annie was living currently with her father, Nichols. So that was a big reason for writing this book and wanting to do this investigation, as you write. Now, tell us about what you find about the investigation itself. Obviously, this was March 16th, 2009 in Hood River County. Of course, you were re-examining this after the fact. What? Tell us about the actual crime itself.
Well, the
911 call,
again,
I should say.
Right, the 911 call is that on March 16th, 2009, about 6 o'clock in the evening, this is in Hood River, Oregon, which is a town in the Columbia River Gorge. And they get a call from the parking lot of a popular trail there called the Eagle Creek Trail. From a man who first talks about that he needs help and can you send somebody and all this sort of thing, and kind of takes him a minute or two before he lets them know that his girlfriend has fallen from the cliff and he believes that she's dead. And that kind of starts the whole process of obviously the police showing up and eventually a search and rescue team showing up. But it's an odd 911 call. Just there's some aspect about it. You know, he's obviously more concerned that he's cold and wet. And some other things that will come into play later on in this investigation.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that 911 call is recorded, and of course, people, investigators, police, everyone will look at that and review that later. You talked about the idea that one of the first things that people can judge or police do, and they do put in their reports, is the behavior, and you talked about the coldness. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what this whole idea that he was so cold and preoccupied with his own condition rather than what some people might think is a normal response to his girlfriend, his fiance, just being dead. So tell us what the first responders, or he's talking to the 911 operator, and then there's the first responder, and what does that first responder encounter in terms of behavior from this person?
Well, again, it's this person who we learn by this time is Stephen Nichols. He talks about that, you know, he tried to get to the body and he tried to swim up a creek and he's wet and cold. And it is March in Oregon and it had rained and some sleet that day. So it's chilly outside. But, I'd ask anybody out there, if you're hiking on a trail and you're the person you love, your fiance, plunges off the cliff, what is your first thing you're probably going to say to the 911 call operator? That you're cold and can somebody please help you? Or are you going to say, my girlfriend fell off a cliff and I think she's dead? And then maybe, by the way, I'm cold and I need some help. Those sorts of things that, you look at as an investigator, it's demeanor, evidence, if you will, and demeanor evidence does count in the courtroom, by the way. And so these sorts of things that some people were almost right away, and by people, I mean the first responders, were kind of taken back a little bit by this guy who is sort of phlegmatic when he speaks, is monotone. He's still more concerned about how cold he is. And then when they get him in the ambulance, now he's had a little bit of time in his car with the heater warmed up, but his body temperatures are normal.
Yeah. Right away, too, you have one of the first responders is a person from an interesting unit called the Crag Rats. And these guys are experienced with rescue. And also, this person personally is experienced with the trail itself and where it might be more difficult or more prone to somebody having any kind of situation, since there is a place called Suicide Point on this trail. Tell us what his impression was. You say about other people doubting, you talk about doubting the story, but this person, based on that experience, has even more of a, I'd say, a stronger opinion about that.
Well, yes, Jeff Pritcher, who is both the chief of the Cascade Locks, which is the nearest small town to this trail, of their fire department, and a paramedic, as well as being one of these Crag Rats, which is one of the top search and rescue teams probably in the country. They've been at it a long time. They do mountains, they do rivers, they do just about everywhere. They have a lot of territory they cover. And he's struck, too, just when he talks to Nichols at the parking lot about this guy's demeanor and some of the things he's saying as far as, you know, he pulled her from the river and that he tried to get up the river and tried to swim up the river, and a number of little things that, you know, he just kind of, at that moment, files in the back of his head as sort of strange. And then when another volunteer shows up fairly quickly after that, they head up the trail to see if they can find the point where she went off so they can locate her body. Nichols had said he thought it was a mile up the trail or a mile and a half or something along these lines. So they had to, and it's starting to get dark, so they had to kind of hurry up there and see if they can spot her from the trail up above.
Yeah, you say that they have difficulty even getting down there, so we'll talk about that. But at the same time, you have that Deputy Smith has heard the 911 call. Now he wants to know, to hear the story. So police want to hear the story from Steve Nichols. And so what does he say about Rhonda, their hike, her behavior, and the accident itself, as he describes it?
Well, Nichols first, and he will change his story a number of times throughout this,
sure,
talking to police officers until he finally quits talking at all. But his basic thing is they went up there and she was acting crazy, even though he says he doesn't remember her doing any drugs or smoking any pot or anything else like that. And she's running down the trail with a towel around her neck, playing like she's Supergirl or Superman, and running down this trail and slips and goes over the edge. And that's his story, that they were having a hike, they're trying to lose weight. She doesn't mention any, in fact, he denies there's any sort of argument or fight or anything else along those lines. So, basically that's his story, is that she's acting a little crazy and running down the trail before she falls.
He also is witness to Steve Nichols not answering his phone and then inquiring who that would be and why he wouldn't be answering his phone. And that's the first we hear of the sister that Rhonda has, Melanie, but also that he was going to have a hard time telling Rhonda's mother what has happened. Tell us about this phone call and what Smith maybe surmises from this, if anything.
Well, during this time when they're talking, he does receive a couple of calls, and he basically tells the officer, oh, well, that's her mom wondering where she is, and, you know, what do I tell her, and do I contact her? At that time, it's not terribly suspicious other than the police officer notes it, and that, you know, and tells Nichols, don't worry, we'll have once we've confirmed all of this, we'll have law enforcement get in touch with the family and let them know. Later on, it will become kind of interesting in that when they do look at his phone again, when they ask to see his phone and he hands it over for a little bit, all of the messages that he'd received or sent weren't on the phone. They weren't on the caller ID. So that makes you wonder, well, where did they all go, and did he erase them all? And if so, why did he erase them all?
Right. What are the we get back to the Craig rats again. So when they go down and finally find the body, what is the condition of Rhonda's body? What do they note? And, of course, they've already spoken to Steve Nichols, and he has given them an account of how she got down there, under what circumstances. Tell us what they just even see immediately.
Well, and I don't want to give too much away here. It's an important part of the book. But we can get into, for one thing, it was very difficult. And these guys, I mean, they climb mountains, they rope in, they do everything. It was very, very difficult to find a place, one, to even get down the cliff. And then they had to make their way back towards the body. Which was a struggle for even two very experienced mountaineers. And then when they find her, one of the main things that they noted that I'll reveal here is that Nichols told a couple of different first responders that when he looked over the edge, he saw her laying in the water of Eagle Creek.
Right.
The distance between the cliff and Eagle Creek was probably about 160 feet, so almost, 60 yards or something along there, not quite, 55. But anyway, there's quite a distance between the cliff and the creek. When they find Rhonda's body, she's about halfway between the cliff and the creek. So if you're going to go with Nichols' story, well, then he found her laying in the water, and one of the crag rats, Jeff Pritcher, that he pulled her from the water. And then she's a good 80 feet from the creek towards the cliff, dragged up a slope with one of her leg bones jutting from her thigh, and obviously not alive, even though he said that he tried to give her CPR. So it struck the crag rats as, well, you found her in the water, one. Wouldn't you just pull her up on the bank and turn her over and try to do CPR there? And then if that didn't work, why would you then drag her 80 feet up the hill only to leave her where she was left and then make your way back to the parking lot? They didn't see any evidence of any disturbance of the ground either on the way to her body, and they had to cross a couple of different places where it's likely that some sort of track would have been left, but even around the body, none of the area had been disturbed. And that was one of the clues that they had that, you know, this story just isn't working the way the, Nichols was saying it did. And so they quickly determined that it was a good possibility this was a crime scene. So they took photographs and backed up out of there. There were a number of other details that I'll let readers find in the book as to what how they came to that conclusion. But that was one of the main ones, is that he said, oh, she's laying in the water. And so if she was lying in the water, why did he drag her so far up there where she's obviously got these horrendous injuries and leave her where she was?
You talk about the ensuing investigation, and again, not to give anything away, but you talk about the Deputy Smith is at the hospital, and an interesting drug, gabapentin. You say it's anti-seizure, antidepressant, nerve pain medication. How does this drug play into this? And can we talk about the autopsy and its results, especially given what Nichols has said, that he is more than intimated that she was high on drugs on that cliff or on that trail?
Well, I guess it comes down to the gabapentin is, it's actually more of a used more as a pain medication, though there's some antidepressant qualities in it. Rhonda did have some postpartum issues, but remember, this is 9 months later, and she'd actually stopped taking it for a while and was back taking it. She, on her doctor's advice, but even in the autopsy, it barely registered. In fact, she barely registered for anything. She had a little bit of cannabinoid, or what am I saying here? The residue left over from marijuana, but it was at such a low level that it also could have been either a false positive or that she was around people that smoked. She had told people, and most people believed her, that especially after the birth of her daughter, she had stopped taking any kind of drugs. But what she did have in her system was legally prescribed as far as anything else, and in such minimal amounts that it's hard to imagine that she was having some sort of drug reaction. She certainly didn't have any sort of hallucinogens in her or anything along those lines, or enough pot residue to have caused her to run down the trail like Superman.
Right. Now, in the ensuing investigation, of course, you have the Deputy Smith, but he's joined by a guy named Deputy English, and these guys want to find out what he does for a living, and of course, they have to investigate all the possible motives for this crime if it's not going to be an accident, so they're doing their due diligence. Tell us about what kinds of questions they're asking and what kind of answers they're getting from Steve Nichols regarding what he does, what she does, things of that sort.
Well, early on in the initiation, investigation, these first interviews they don't delve too deeply, but he tells them he's a day trader and he makes that's how he makes his money. And a day trader is someone who buys and sells stocks all within a few hours, trying to make a little bit on these transactions. Rhonda basically did not work. She was unemployed. She took care of the baby. She spent time both with Nichols and lived with her mom part of the time. And so that's sort of their financial situation at this time. And then I'll let you lead me into the next parts where I think you're going.
Let's just use this as an opportunity, Steve, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. Tonight's episode is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message the licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. All you need is a computer with internet connection or the Talkspace mobile app. That means you can improve your mental health even if you've had trouble making time for it in the past. get something off your chest whenever you need to. Talk about everyday challenges at work or at home. Just chat about life. There are no extra commutes, no leaving the office, and no judgments. Remember that therapy isn't just about venting your innermost thoughts or digging into childhood memories. It's all about practical, everyday strategies for stress management and living a happier life. Having a therapist simply provides you a designated person for you to talk to who is trained to listen and help you make positive changes. The Talkspace platform has over 2,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing life challenges we all face. To match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/murder and use the code MURDER to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. That's MURDER and Talkspace.com/murder. Now, Steve, we were talking about the ensuing investigation and what Steve Nichols had to say. How do they get to the point where they, you talk about another person becoming involved, a Corporal Mickelson. When do they first hear some rumblings of the real motive, or in their mind, a motive for this murder? Who do they talk to, and what do those people say?
Well, the initial investigators are with Hood River County Sheriff's Office, and that's Detective Tiffany and Deputies English and Deputy Smith, who you've discussed. Rhonda and Steve and Rhonda's mom and family all live in Portland, which is Washington County. So there's some office dealings here, and one of the Washington County deputies, Mickelson, who you've talked about, calls English, and this is within, you know, a very short amount of time, within a couple of hours of reaching the trailhead, talking to Nichols, and then finally they are able to locate Rhonda's mom and through her the rest of the family, and start talking to them. And right away, the family says they think that he did it, and they note that he had taken out a large $1 million, they thought it might even be more, life insurance policy on Rhonda. And this, of course, immediately sends up a red flag.
Now, at the same time, or soon after, they talk to the mother, Julia Simmons. Then there is Rhonda's sister, Melanie. How do they get to the point where they hear any rumblings of the relationship of Melanie and Steve?
Well, both a little bit from the family, but also one of Melanie's former boyfriends calls the police after he sees a broadcast, television broadcast, about Rhonda falling. Even though it did not mention Nichols by name at that time, he sort of guessed. And he knew about the insurance policy, and he knew about some other things, but what he knew that the detectives didn't have as much of at that time was that when Melanie was 15 years old, and this was would have been 4 years earlier, Nichols had had a sexual affair with her, and had continued this affair for quite some time, and that Melanie had actually at one point got angry and told Rhonda in front of her mom and Nichols that they were having this affair, and obviously Melanie is underage, and Steve Nichols at the time of this affair started was 30 years old. And it became obvious in some of the investigation that ensued from that Nichols was had an infatuation with Melanie Casto, who was Rhonda's younger sister, and to the point where he was texting her within Actually, he picked her up and took her over to her mom's house after Rhonda died. Melanie said he said a number of odd things, such as it only takes a baby 6 months to forget someone, and what's really odd is he's a number of texts to her afterwards, and there's the hey, we're friends still, and can I talk to you, and these sorts of things. Nowhere in there does he say, I'm grieving for Rhonda. And this is supposedly his fiance that he, allegedly was taking on this hike to as a romantic place to propose to her. There's just another one of these flags that the police are seeing why do none of these texts say anything about Rhonda? They're all about, getting together with Melanie and, inviting her up to where he's living now with his family and helping him take care of Annie and all of these sorts of things. So now the police start working on two different motivators, and one is the $1 million insurance policy, and the other one is that he obviously wants to be together with Melanie, Rhonda's younger sister, and according to Melanie now, had told her that they couldn't be together as long as Rhonda was around.
What Mickelson is hearing and the police are hearing too is incredibly are jokes shared between Rhonda and Steve that the family is privy to. Now, what kind of jokes would these people make, and how cryptic would they be considering?
Well, this insurance policy that we've talked about, Steve arranged for this in Steve Nichols arranged for this in November of 2008, just 4 months before. In fact, the policies, which is a whole another can of worms in itself, just how they got these policies. $1 million on someone who was unemployed is pretty unusual. But yeah, sure. Going forward from there, they didn't even receive the policies until January. But anyway, they have, they both took out Nichols originally only wanted to have about $250,000 on his policy and $1 million on Rhonda's. But the insurance company made them both have $1 million equal policies. So they now have these $1 million policies. And Melanie says she's around when they're this couple, Rhonda, her sister, and Nichols are joking about, who's going to kill who as far as to get the life insurance policy. And enough to the point where Melanie was actually concerned about it. She thought, that this couple fought a lot. They really did not belong together, just to start with. But anyway, so they're joking about killing each other. Nichols at some point talks about shoving Rhonda off a cliff, according to Melanie. Now, we have to always remember that some of this is coming along after the fact. These are stories and anecdotes that are being told to the police after the fact. But one of the facts is that these are being told within a day, 2 days after Rhonda's death. So, again, it's how quickly these, if these stories are being made up, they're being made up very quickly, and everybody is getting their story together very quickly.
Right.
All apparently, trying to get Steve Nichols. At least that's from his side, that's what he would be saying on that.
Now, at the same time, too, we have this other idea that they have to investigate the idea of looking at Rhonda's sister, Melanie, and that love triangle possibility motive, but also they find out information regarding a jeweler named Kassab Jeweler. Tell us about this story and what they find and what Steve has to say about it and what they find contrary to that.
Well, part of this, as I mentioned a little earlier, part of it was that Nichols was going to ask Rhonda to marry him. And, in fact, Rhonda told her grandmother before they left on this hike, he's either going to give me a ring or push me off a cliff. Sort of half in jest and sort of you wonder, you know, is this something she was really thinking about? Nichols told Julia Simmons, who is Rhonda's mother, that he had purchased an engagement ring from this jeweler, Kassab Jeweler, which is a very nice jeweler in downtown Portland, Oregon, and that, you know, they picked out the ring and that he'd purchased it for her, and he was taking her on this trail. Julia's boyfriend noted a jewelry bag in the back of the car on the seat when they left, and so everybody, maybe he did buy a ring and was going to propose to her. And they did know that they had been, the couple, Rhonda in particular, had been to the jeweler looking at various cuts and settings. Steve had gone a couple of times. That always seemed sort of, you know, his least favorite thing to do. And so Julia asked him, well, okay, well, where is the ring? And this is within a day or so, maybe two, after Rhonda's death. And he told her, according to Julia, that he had already taken the ring back. And got a refund for it, which is, you know, if you think about it, is awfully quick to decide I'm taking the ring back for my fiance who just fell off a cliff. Anyway, Julia tells a police officer that she called the jeweler and asked them about this, and that they'd said, well, we remember the couple because we keep a very detailed log of who comes in and looks for jewelry and that sort of thing, but they never purchased one, much less ever come in to return a ring. There was no ring bought for him to return.
Right. Also, what they find is that, and you say this is, it's going to be difficult to get around this, or this is going to be problematic, is what you say, is that when Melanie made these allegations when she was 15 years of age, a lot of people didn't believe her, including her mother. But someone did and called authorities and police. Why is that?
Right.
Tell us.
Well, there's actually two crimes that are being investigated at this point. One is two potential crimes. One is what happened to Rhonda. Did she slip and fall, or was she pushed? So that's a homicide investigation. But now there's this secondary investigation into whether Nichols is guilty of sexual abuse of a minor, and which is also a felony. And so there's that investigation going on as well. You know, they're thinking ahead, looking at the possibilities of this charge, and if it gets to court. And the problematic part was that when Melanie told everybody that I'm having an affair with Nichols, he denied it immediately, said she was a liar, no one else believed her either at that point when she said it. But Melanie also told one of her friends who told her mom, and the mom called the police and social services to look into this. When the police and social services asked Julia about it, Rhonda's mom, she said that she thought Melanie was lying about it and that Melanie was using drugs. And basically she took Nichols word that he didn't do it, and you know, Rhonda at that point, you know, she's engaged to this guy. She's going to have a baby with this guy at some point, and is also denies it. So, you know, they're looking at, well, if we get this in the court, the first thing a defense attorney is going to do is call Julia Simmons up and say, didn't you tell police at that time that she was a liar and she was on drugs? So this is going to, it's not a cut and dry case of, you know, that where you don't have the girl's own mother saying she's a liar.
You also have another police official or detective, Rosebrough, that becomes involved too. And to further complicate this too is that there was different times where she lived with the couple, her sister and Steve Nichols, and engaged in sexual relations with them, and then moved out. And so, and her story changed, and till this Rosebrough, I guess, really dug in and got the facts behind this. You also talk about a third motive as this investigation proceeds. Amazingly, if it wasn't enough motivation that they found all this evidence, that there's another motive. Tell us what this third motive was and what they found in that part of the investigation.
Well, the third motive is that Nichols had been appointed the trustee for a trust that his mother had set up on behalf of his sister and half-sister, which was a rental building in San Diego. And basically he was supposed to be, you know, kind of managing it for them. He would get the statements from the property manager and all these sorts of things. And, you know, as a trustee, you're supposed to be watching out for the interests of the people involved in the trust. But this property was mortgaged to, it's about $1 million property, and it was mortgaged to about $250,000, you know, at the time that it went into the trust that the mother had died. Now we get to the summer of 2008, and the sisters find out that for some reason there's now the property now has an $800,000 mortgage against it because this takes a number of months, they find out it's because Nichols has taken out two personal loans against the property, and he had no right to do that. He wasn't supposed to be getting money out of this, and now this property is obviously much less valuable. In fact, most of the profits coming from the rental are going to pay the loans that he took out on it. So he's obviously using this money to do his day trading and whatever else he was doing with it, to the tune of he had taken out about another $500,000 against this property. And so they weren't getting payments except for every once in a while, a little bit here and a little bit there. So they eventually, while this is going on, file a lawsuit against Nichols to get, in their name, the deeds away from him, as well as to force him to do an accounting of whatever happened to this $500,000, plus all the money that came into it, which essentially went to paying the loan. So all this money over the course of how many years, and I believe it's close to about $40,000 a month was coming in, that went somewhere else, and so did the equity in this property went somewhere else. So they sued, but here's the big but on this one, is the police didn't find this. They did not know about this possible motive, which is that shortly before he went to, he looked into life insurance, he'd been confronted by his siblings who said, hey, we're on to you. Whatever happened to this money, and we want to know about it now. So if you put it all together, is he's confronted in October by his siblings about this. November, he goes and gets life insurance against on Rhonda's life. In less than 2 weeks before Rhonda died, they filed a lawsuit against him, asking for a judgment that he, provide an accounting for all of this and also hand over the deeds. So he's in serious financial trouble with his siblings when he signs up for life insurance policy, this policy, and then, shortly after Rhonda's death, there's a judgment against him saying, give over the deeds and account for the money. But at this time, the police don't even know about it, and this is one of those things where, if they'd asked one of his siblings anything about him, they would have found out about this. That's a pretty powerful motive for wanting money and needing to come up with a lot of money fast.
Exactly. You also, in this, include on August 25th, 2009, Sherry Lee and her daughter Beth. Tell us about this story.
Well, while all this is going on, Steve Nichols moves up to a community near Bend, Oregon, to live with his parents' half-brother, and he has Annie with him at this point. And one night he takes his half-brother and his friends and a young girl, 13-year-old, swimming at a pool, obviously. And they're in the pool playing Marco Polo. He decides to join the kids. His half-brother is 14. I believe the other boy was as well. There's the 13-year-old. And she feels him grab her butt during this play. And first she thinks it's an accident, but he does it again. And she tells him to stop, and he sort of, okay, ha, ha, ha. But again, she would later say that he did it several more times. He gets her home about an hour late. The mom's upset, but, doesn't know what to make of it. Then a few days later, hold on just a minute. A few days later, she is kind of snooping through her daughter's text from some man who, just goes by Steve, and he's all sorts of things. He's asking her for hot photos of her and her friends. He sends her a text asking if she wants to get in a hot tub with him and three hot men, including the two boys. Teenage boys,
yeah,
and his friend. And he sends a photograph of himself shirtless in his bedroom, taking a photo of himself in a mirror. Obviously, a 34-year-old man sending these sorts of photos to a 13-year-old girl is pretty inappropriate. And finally, she breaks down and tells her mom, well, this is what happened that night. He grabbed me, and then he was sending me these texts. And she's 13 years old. It's not like she didn't respond at all, but she did finally stop, break it off with him, because she found he was just weirdly creepy and got uncomfortable with this whole thing. And eventually, so the mom calls the police, and the police look into it. And this is in Deschutes County Sheriff's Office, which is where Bend is. And they come over, they listen to these stories. Nichols doesn't realize that they know about the text and have seen the text, and so he lies about it. That's one of the things he is particularly good at, is lying. And so he lies about this, and they catch him in these lies, and he's arrested and charged with felony counts of sexual abuse to a minor. And he tries to explain it as, oh, well, my girlfriend died recently, and, you know, I'm upset, and this girl is a friend, and we talk. And once again, you get around to why is a 34-year-old man feel that his closest confidant is a 13-year-old girl that he's sending half-naked photos of himself to.
Yeah, certainly nonsense. You say that he was released on $50,000 bail, but each one of these sexual abuse one charges, each could net him a possible 10 years. But you say
Right. Investigation,
however, goes cold.
And that's sort of where we end book one, is that at this stage, whether it is the all these different sheriff's offices at this time, Hood River, Washington County, and Deschutes, Deschutes is made aware that he is under investigation in some of these other cases. And we'll leave it at that. They sort of stop doing much of anything as they watch the process of what's going on in Deschutes County with this underage minor case. Obviously, that's very tied to the Washington County case where Melanie Casto says he was doing the same thing, actually much more, that they'd actually had a sexual affair. A very similar case, and obviously Nichols, from his text and everything else, was attempting to groom this other young woman. The invitations, hey, let's go out. Hey, send me, hot photos of yourself, and these sorts of things. So that's where book one ends, with the case growing cold or stalled, or I don't know how you want to describe it, but both of those work. But Nichols is he's under investigation for homicide. He's under investigation in two different places for sexual abuse of a minor, and he's being sued by his siblings. And book two will pick up from there.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Steve Jackson, for coming on and talking about the first book in the series, Saving Annie, The Fall. And the next book will be called The Investigator of the Saving Annie series. I want to thank you very much, Steve, for coming on and talking about this. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thanks, Dan. It's always great talking to you. You have a great show.
For those that might not know, this is a Wild Blue Press production publication. You are the publisher. So tell us maybe how they can just go see what more work you have and other very, very deserving authors that are on Wild Blue Press.
Well, you can go to wildbluepress.com. That's wildbluepress.com. And we have a lot of great true crime authors and books now. We've been in business since 2014 and have been picking up steam ever since. We're now putting out about two true crimes a month and the occasional crime thriller as well. You can find my work there. You can find the work of a number of both well-known true crime authors, as well as we take on the deserving rookie from time to time, and there are some really good books in there.
Absolutely. You've been doing a great job, and especially with all the great authors that really didn't have a publisher that understood true crime and understood the genre as well as you, and so you've put out some really, really good titles and with a great roster of really, really good authors. Thank you very much for another Wild Blue Press production, Saving Annie. Thank you very much, Steve Jackson. Hope to talk to you again soon. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thanks, Dan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.